few weeks back, we had Anna Fifield teed up for Calling Home, where Kiwis living abroad talk about their lives and the times of the countries they live in. But then Anna got absolutely swamped by the worldwide reaction to her book, The Great Successor, The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Kim Jong-un. And she chatted on Saturday morning to Noel McCarthy about that book. But it was her life we'd wanted to talk about in the main. And this morning we get the chance to do that. Anna is the Beijing Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. She went to Victoria and Canterbury Universities in the 1990s. And later she was a Nieman Fellow in Journalism at Harvard. Anna's been away from New Zealand for 19 years now, with postings in London, Sydney, Seoul, Tehran, Beirut, Washington, D.C., Boston, Tokyo, and now China. Anna Fifield, hello.
Hello, Jim. Nice to be here.
Oh, lovely to talk to you. And I shan't talk to you much about your book with the wonderful title, because you did a long and fascinating interview with Noel. But you must be thrilled by the reception it's had.
Yeah, I really am. You know, this was a project that I toiled away on at like 4 o'clock in the morning by myself for 2 years. So now to have the book out and people reading it and saying nice things and feels great. But also I could not have hoped for a better advertisers than Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, who have been making lots of news and, you know, creating a lot of buzz, you know, about their personal relationship and who Kim Jong-un is. So I think the curiosity about this guy is just only increased.
I want to ask you about that just briefly, if I may, because, yes, we've had another powwow between the two of them. I saw a headline this morning, Trump's North Korea meeting was a good photo op, but don't be fooled by the theatre. And I thought, Anna, we aren't fooled by the theatre. I mean, some of the narratives around these meetings have involved clichés and assume we're a bit thick. The question is whether this kind of weird love fest will ever actually lead to anything. What do you think?
I think it's too early to tell, but I do think, yes, it was a real show in the DMZ. Kim Jong-un's got away without providing any substance yet again. But I do think it was an important photo opportunity for them to have, because the fact is that both of them have made clear that they want to continue this diplomatic process, but it wasn't at all clear how they would get back to the talks after they, you know, broke down so spectacularly in Hanoi in February this year. So the fact that these two unconventional leaders were able to meet this way and kickstart the talks is a good thing. Yeah, but the devil is in the details. There's another cliche for you. you know, we have to wait and see whether they can actually make any progress. I mean, I definitely do not think that Kim Jong-un's giving up his nuclear weapons anytime soon.
Your book is really interesting about Kim Jong-un and shrewd with its insights. And it is entertaining watching Trump try and be his bestie. But do you get the feeling Trump in his own way is just as hard-nosed, just not as murderous?
I mean, there are certainly a lot of similarities between the two of them. And like some of them are just kind of where they came from. Obviously, I mean, I should say there are a lot of differences. I'm not saying that Donald Trump is anything like Kim Jong-un, you know, but the fact that they were both not the obvious heir to their fathers, you know, Donald Trump is the second son, Kim Jong-un is the third son, you know, they both are in their way real estate developers. You know, Kim Jong-un has presided over this, a lot of construction and building in North Korea. They both, you know, have this kind of vision. So, but also they're both kind of leaders who follow their gut and who are doing things differently. So, yeah, so I think there is some overlap, and they're both these, you know, personalistic kind of leaders. So it takes these two guys at the top, I think, to maybe give the orders for things to happen. But, I mean, that's to gloss over all of the many differences. Like, Donald Trump does not have his aides executed when they run afoul of him. He just gets rid of them on Twitter.
On to you. You've reported, I think, from more than 20 countries. Has there been a posting that was your favourite for whatever reasons, please?
I really loved being in Iran. I was posted to Iran in 2008. Iran was just such a fascinating place because it's so different from what people expect it's going to be like. And it's so kind of multi-layered and fascinating. And I had fun there. You know, I went to crazy parties and, you know, went to picnics by the Caspian Sea. And, you know, it's like just very different from this outside image of mullahs and, you know, death to America and stuff that you see in the outside world. But also as a journalist, it's just, you know, fantastic because there are very, very few foreign correspondents there and a huge amount of interest in Iran. So, you know, everything I wrote was kind of lapped up in a way. So if I could go back to Iran, I definitely would.
You've lived away from New Zealand for almost two decades now. Is there a place in New Zealand or an image, you know, like a beach with a pahuta kawa tree on it, an image or images that you hold in your mind?
The thing that always gets me and that I love doing is that walk between the international terminal and domestic in Auckland. And it's not a particularly pleasant walk. You know, there's all of the, you know, those petrol tanks and things there and stuff. But for me, that's really being home because I, yeah, usually come home at Christmas time and that walk is lined with pahuta kawas. And I mean, even if it's raining, even if it's cold, whatever, even if it's like the morning, you know, dawn, I always do that walk because for me, that means I'm really home.
Ah, yeah. That's interesting. So you're the bureau chief for the Washington Post in Beijing. What is the job? Well, I won't ask you all of that entails because we can guess some of it, but it must be very demanding. That's a high pressure job.
Yeah, it is very demanding because obviously I write a lot. You know, I have my journalistic responsibilities, and I'm trying to write a lot of news and get out and about and travel around China to write feature stories. And, you know, now we have to be completely multimedia. We do the Washington Post podcast and we record video and audio and all these kinds of things. But yes, there is a lot of kind of managerial and administrative stuff that comes with this job and meeting with government officials who are unhappy with our reporting or with somebody else's reporting in the Washington Post. And that side of the job is not so fun.
Where do you live in Beijing?
I live in a compound. It is called Park Avenue, which is the only time in my life I'll ever live on Park Avenue. You know, it's quite hilarious, all these compounds. There's one called Central Park. There's one called Palm Springs is next door. My building is like a city block. It's nine apartment buildings around a big kind of open park area. It's really beautiful. But yeah, we have a nice, comfortable life here.
It's a big, bustling city, isn't it? 20 million people. How does it compare, out of interest, with some of the other large international cities you've lived in?
It compares well, I think. For one thing, you know, Beijing is a very cycling-friendly city because it's completely flat. I bike everywhere. So in that way, it's very different from London or Tehran or other places where there's no well, there is biking in London, but I think it feels more dangerous. And I mean, I check the air quality often, and you know, this past week it's been comparable with New Zealand.
Oh, really?
So I mean, there certainly are bad air days, and sometimes, you know, it's off the charts. Yes, and we cannot go outside, or if we do go outside, we wear masks and things like that. But those days are very few compared to what they were even a few years ago.
So you have to respond to criticism of Western reportage and so on. How much of an issue is censorship and being monitored, you know, both in your work and in general day-to-day life?
Yeah, I assume that I'm monitored all the time. My, you know, we use this app called WeChat for everything in China. That's the way that people communicate with each other and the way I pay for everything. You know, I never use cash. I just use my WeChat account, scan a code. So I assume that the authorities are reading all of that all the time. And I've never, you know, I haven't had an issue where I've obviously been followed, but if I was doing a sensitive story, say in Xinjiang or something, then yes, I would be not just electronically monitored, but actually physically monitored at the same time. But I have, you know, having reported in Iran and North Korea and Syria and Libya and things, I feel like I have a high tolerance for this kind of thing now that I've just learned to live with it. I write what I need to write. You know, my job is to be a journalist and to write the story as I see it. And if that means my visa gets denied, you know, so be it. I'm really talking about North Korea and around there, that I could not pull my punches and be an honest journalist there. So now I can't get back into North Korea because of what I've written. But
yes, I saw that. Speaking of Xinjiang province, I saw the New York Times, The Guardian and Motherboard have run a story saying foreigners are being forced to install a piece of malware on their phones that gives all their text messages and other data to the authorities. And of course, they're looking for Islamic extremist content. I wonder whether China, because you at Harvard, I think you studied how change happens in closed societies. I wonder whether China can keep a lid on this problem and the issues it's having in Hong Kong. Do you see any cracks appearing in the apparatus?
No, I don't, because it's incredible how pervasive this surveillance is. Yes, there have been some reports that they've been installing this software on people's phones at this one border. But, you know, everybody in China has this app, WeChat, on their phone that they can monitor everything pretty much through that app anyway. I mean, everything is done through your phone and through that app here. So there's a lot of monitoring, but also, you know, facial recognition cameras are everywhere in China, especially around sensitive places. So even so much that there are some cities in China that if you were to cross the road on a red light, I'm not even exaggerating, like jaywalking is the kind of thing where the facial recognition camera will pick you up and then put your face and your national identity card on this huge jumbotron screen at that intersection to shame you about it. So they have, and there was a case, you know, somebody who jaywalked, a foreigner in the southern city of Shenzhen, wrote about how they did jaywalk and then they were fined automatically, a deducted like 50 RMB from their WeChat account for, as a, you know, he didn't even do anything, like he didn't have to approve it or anything. They just took the money from him to shame him or to punish him for jaywalking. So there is so much monitoring that people, that the government can do here, that it's very, very difficult to escape it. And this is something that we as journalists face, you know, when we were doing coverage ahead of the Tiananmen anniversary, trying to arrange interviews with activists without getting caught by this apparatus was very, very difficult because I had to think about the cameras and the WeChat and all of the stuff about the ways that the government could see what we were doing and try to thwart it.
We have talked a bit about the frightening sides of China in recent weeks, and of course, you've eloquently described one of them. But there also are amazing sides. And I noticed that Beijing has recently completed this airport, this Golden Phoenix, huge $16 billion airport.
Yeah, brand new airport. The last one's only 10 years old, that they built it in 2008 for the Olympics. So yes, there's this huge new airport that will be, I think, the busiest in the world when it opens. But also the train system is something to behold in China. And I really felt that when I was just in the US a few weeks ago, going on American trains and trying to connect to Wi-Fi. I felt like I was in the third world. And I was like, I can't wait to get back to China with, you know, high-speed rail and, you know, very fast internet. So in general, yeah, they've been able to pour a lot of money into these big infrastructure projects. But yes, whether they make financial sense is another question.
The food, I have to ask you, do you eat out often? And what local food do you most enjoy?
Yeah, we eat out often. It's like, especially to eat locally, it's so cheap and delicious. You know, I love noodles, particularly my son loves pork, xiaolongbao, these steamed dumplings that he can't get enough of. So he recently said that he loves these even more than pizza, which was surprising to me. I love Sichuan food, the tingly mala. It's called like the numbing, tingly, spicy food is delicious. I am a vegetarian. I've been a vegetarian for 30 years. And so in some countries like Japan, this was an absolute nightmare for me because everything is fish. So it was incredibly difficult to be vegetarian in Japan. But in China, it's so easy. There's so many vegetables and tofu dishes, and there's a lot that's meatless anyway. So that is a really pleasant surprise for me about living in China.
I imagine your son is a citizen of the world. I'm getting that impression as you talk in many ways. Could you ever come back to New Zealand and just watch the wheels go round, as John Lennon put it once? Would you be able to live that kind of life again?
Yeah, I mean, it has a lot of appeal to me. I love the idea of that. And I always love being home. And when I'm there with my friends and our kids are, you know, eating fish and chips and playing on the beach, it's like, why do I not live here? And he would really like to live in New Zealand. I guess it would depend on the right job coming up to bring me home.
I would think the jobs of the world are at your feet at the moment, but with what you've just written and things you've accomplished. So congratulations. All right.
Thank you, Jim.
Immediately, one more question. If there was one country you could be posted to that you have not been, and one country where you could apply that fresh set of eyes once more, where would that be?
Oh, I mean, the posting that everybody wants is Rome. I mean, I think it would be fantastic. This is more about the life than the story, I think. I'm always struck when I go to Europe, having, you know, lived in Asia for all this time, at the whole work-life balance. I mean, I'm struck about that in New Zealand as well. When I was home in Christchurch and I tried to call people at 7 o'clock at night, they were like, no, call me tomorrow. Because, yeah, there is more of a sense that you must have time off and, you know, have a leisure time and things. So time with your family. So I think that's something I would like to have more of. And the idea of, yes, sitting in Rome, drinking an Aperol Spritz at 5 o'clock in the evening does have a lot of appeal. So fingers crossed for that job one day. And then I'll come home.
You've given us a lot of your valuable time in a busy life, Anna Fifield. Thank you very much for coming on.
And thank you for having me, Jim. I really enjoyed it.